Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the rededication of the Gaddar Commemoration Plaque on Saturday, April 7th at noon at the Astoria Maritime Park in Astoria. The Gaddar Party was founded in Astoria in 1913. It became a global movement to end British colonial rule in India. Its roots in Astoria, including ties to Finnish and other labor radicals, were honored in 2013 with a celebration and a plaque. That plaque was stolen last October. The East Indian community and other people of conscience will gather to rededicate and celebrate its installation on April 7th. Again, that's the rededication of the Gaddar Commemoration Plaque on Saturday, April 7th at noon at the Astoria Maritime Park, 200 West Marine Drive in Astoria, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned into The Bike Show, broadcasting here live from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tori Bortman, here joined today with our new co-host, April Streeter. Good morning, April.
Good morning.
For most of us, bikes are not just a way to recreate or play around, but a valuable tool to get to work, pick up the groceries, take our kids to daycare, and generally replace a car. We didn't get licensed to ride our bikes, and we learned on the road using safety, self-preservation, and the laws applied to driving as our guide. Often, we've chosen bicycles as transportation because it's convenient, economical, and a quicker, more in-touch way to interact with the world. Today, we're taking a deeper dive into a group of people using bikes for their work, one of the more difficult jobs out there, the police, and hear more about why bikes are the tool of choice for some types of policing. First, we'll be joined by Officer Todd Engstrom, Advanced Academy Coordinator for the Portland Police Bureau's Training Division, about how the Portland Police use bicycles every day and what kind of training it takes to become a bike cop. In the second half of the hour, we're joined by Sergeant Steve Wicks, founder of the Houston Police Department's Homeless Outreach Team, to share with us how bikes are being used by the department to help get people living outside into housing and a discussion of the difference between enforcement and outreach styles of policing. First, though, April will bring us some of the latest headlines from this week, April 4th, 2018. April?
Thanks, Tori. Thanks to Alon for getting together these news flashes. CityLab Latino reports on a creative and peaceful alternative to the planned wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, connecting the cities of El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez in the state of Chihuahua by an integrated bi-national bike share system. That initiative, proposed by El Paso's Metropolitan Planning, aims for a system available on both sides of the Rio Grande. Michael Medina, executive director, said it would be practical as a lot of people that travel to El Paso are dropped off at the border, walk through the bridge, and then they either get the bus on the other side or someone picks them up. So we thought, what if they could get directly to their destination using a bicycle? The plan would require new lanes and infrastructure, as well as cooperation with immigration agencies. Separate booths for bikers would enable quick crossing. About 18,000 pedestrians cross into El Paso daily. We're trying to improve people's quality of life, says Medina. We want people to move from the car and switch to the bike to cross the border. In a story from WeLoveCycling.com, in Trondheim, Norway, a country where bicycle infrastructure is already excellent, a bicycle lift similar to a ski lift has been built to make it easier for cyclists going up a steep 130-meter-long hill. Known as Cyclocable, it can transport 300 cyclists an hour. Made of 11-foot plates attached to a wire rope, riders place their right foot onto an approaching footplate, shift their body weight onto this footplate, and then let the lift ferry them up the hill and their bicycles all the way to the top. WeLoveCycling.com also reports of a German NGO called Bikey G's, I hope I got that right, that increases ridership among female refugees, many coming from countries where social and religious taboos and sometimes laws prevent women from cycling. Hundreds of women have taken the opportunity. One new rider, 21-year-old Emily from Afghanistan, described the experience thus: "It gave me the feeling of freedom and self-confidence. It was such a beautiful experience being able to be in control and concentrate on just two wheels. I felt like a bird in the sky." Lily Hirst, one of the great champions of French cycling, died recently, a few days short of her 90th birthday. WordPress.com pays homage to the woman that between 1948 and 1956 was nearly unbeatable. She won the French national road race 9 times. In one race, she broke her collarbone, but continued to the finish line. After retiring, she coached a successful team of women racers and managed the famous bicycle firm founded by her father. And in a story from CyclingWeekly.com, the El Paso house of Lance Armstrong is up for sale. Built in 1924, the 6-bedroom house is described by the real estate agent as a fantastic blend of original charm, modern amenities, and timeless design. The asking price, $7.5 million. No mention is made if the buyer also gets to keep house medals and yellow jerseys won at the Tour de France. Finally, on April 19th, we will note 75 years since Swiss chemist and environmentalist Albert Hofmann became the first person to intentionally ingest LSD, which he synthesized from the ergot fungus a few years earlier. He hopped on his bicycle and rode home, experiencing an altered state of consciousness similar to the one he had felt as a child walking in the Alps. April 19 later became memorialized by LSD fans as Bicycle Day. Hofmann died in 2008 at age 102 and remained a dedicated cyclist for most of his life.
April, thank you so much for that update. Now I'd like to welcome Officer Todd Engstrom, Advanced Academy Coordinator for the Portland Police Bureau's Training Division. As part of his work, Officer Engstrom is in charge of the bicycle training for the Portland Police Bureau. Officer Engstrom, thanks so much for joining us this
morning. You're welcome. You're welcome. Just to clarify, I'm part of a team that's in charge of that bike training. I don't want to leave anybody
out. Okay.
This will get back to them.
Yes. It is on the radio and soon to be on the internet. So yes, it definitely will get back to them. So how did you get involved with the bicycle training or the training part of Portland Police?
So long ago, I've been a Portland police officer for 23, going on 24 years.
Wow.
And we've had a bike squad for all of that time, even before that, and we can get into a little bit of history if you want to. But I went through our bike certification course back in 1997, and it was taught by a combination of Portland police instructors and some Beaverton Police Department instructors, and we held it out at Forest Grove Police Department. And I remember one day we had to ride around Hag Lake on the trail on police bikes with slick street tires. And it was in April, I think. So it was pretty slick. It was kind of a miserable day trying to get around that lake on those bikes.
I wouldn't want to.
So I became a certified bike officer back then, and would ride bikes here and there. But then in 2012, for 3 years, I rode bikes full time as my job in downtown Portland. We have 6 officers that are assigned to bikes full time.
Out of how many officers?
Ooh, I don't know what our, yeah.
There's a lot, not enough right now, but
yeah,
there's a lot.
We're probably sitting at like 940, 950 police officers.
It's not a huge amount.
No, it's a very small amount for officers that are dedicated to doing police work on bicycle.
So are there officers who also use the bicycles at other times?
Yes. So we get them out for special events all the time.
Okay.
And each precinct, so Portland has 3 precincts. So Central Precinct, East Precinct, North Precinct. Each precinct has their own little stash of bicycles. They probably have 15 bicycles that are at that precinct, and they have their own little bike shop, and they have folks that have been trained to work on the bikes to keep them, you know, running, keep them maintained. And they'll get them out, like North, you know, if there's an event going on, Alberta or Albina or up in Mississippi, you know, they'll shut down the streets and they'll have officers patrolling on bicycle. And sometimes if they have enough bodies.
Like a street fair or something like that.
A street fair, correct. Okay. And East Precinct will do the same thing. Sometimes they'll go ride the Springwater Corridor, just kind of being a visible presence out there. And they have ATVs too that they use out there on that. But the majority of the bicycles are housed at Central Precinct in the basement of the Justice Center. And I think citywide, we probably have over 200 bicycles. We have a lot of bicycles.
That's a lot.
And some of them date back to 2005, and there's a bunch of different, you know, kinds. You know, we've kind of changed what we've bought over the years.
Interesting.
So,
yeah, I want to hear more about that later. Okay. But you said you could speak a little bit to the history of...
So, I think Seattle is kind of considered the founding father of modern police work on bicycle. Hmm. And they started their unit in 1987. And
well, that's super early for considering bicycling.
Yeah.
There weren't even that many people commuting on bicycles at that point.
Exactly. So they were kind of cutting edge, and they started this bike unit, and like their first weekend out of the box, they got a bunch of felony drug arrests in the area that they were working, and they thought, hey, this is a good thing. We can do really good work on bicycle. And so Portland, we were right after them. I don't know the specific year, but I'm going to say like 89, 90. Is kind of when we started, and I got hired in 94, so it was still a pretty new program at that point. So when I got hired, staffing was a lot better. You know, the baby boomers were still working, you know, and I'm a Gen Xer, you know, and I was the generation coming to take over for the baby boomers. And we had a lot of bodies working. You know, we had our staffing, I think at that time it was over 1,000. We had 1,050, I think, authorized.
And less people certainly living in Portland at that time.
Yes, population
as well.
Was less. We had more police officers. And so we were able to put officers out on a bicycle. And I was talking to April before the show started. You know, the first priority for police officers is to put them in a car so that they can take 911 calls. And then once you get all those districts filled by cars, then if you have some extra people, then you can kind of put them out on bicycle. And that's kind of the thinking right now. Even though I think working on a bicycle is you can get a lot done on a bicycle.
Yeah.
And I was also wondering, I mean, maybe that's a recruiting tool for millennials, being able to work by bike.
Could be.
Maybe.
I know it's on our recruiting posters. Okay. There's pictures of bike officers on those posters. So it is a draw. And I just had somebody that I was talking to recently that was asking about police work and was into bicycles and said, oh, I would love to be a bike cop. Yeah. And I'm like, well, Portland's one of the only places, maybe the only place in the state that has full-time dedicated officers on bicycles.
So those six are just the full-time dedicated?
Full-time, that's what they do.
Does everyone who ever uses a bike have to go through the bike certification then?
Yeah, yes. You have to, everything in the police bureau requires a certification. So if you're going to...
If you're going to touch that bike.
Yes.
You have to, but that's good.
But it's liability too.
Yeah.
The city wants to know that you're going to be able to get on this bicycle and get from point A to point B without falling down or breaking your neck. I was talking to April and, you know, we've had people come through our officers that are already hired as officers come through the bike class that haven't touched a bicycle in 15 years. And that gets a little dicey, you know,
well,
so their bike skills aren't very good.
I think also one of the things that I would love to see ODOT and or PBOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation or the Portland Bureau of Transportation offer is a driver's ed about what it's like to like drive with bicycles. Mm-hmm. And I think for officers, it's since they're enforcing the law equally for everyone, hopefully, that it's really helpful to be trained as a bicycle officer because that might be the only time that they've been on a bicycle in traffic.
Right.
And having that sense of like, why is the bike doing that? Oh, mm-hmm. Well, there was glass all over the ground that the car couldn't see.
Right.
Or whatever. And that it's not easy. Sometimes bikes are doing things in a different way because pedaling a bike is the easiest part. Starting and stopping and turning and steering a bike, those aren't
in traffic in the city of Portland with parked cars and tight streets and roadways. Yeah. Mass transportation, TriMet buses, streetcars. Yeah. It's a difficult task.
Tracks.
Ugh. Yeah.
And you said that some of the officers that go through, I mean, not everybody automatically passes the certification by bike.
True. We have had a few people because it's a testing process. So
can you tell us more process looks like?
So Portland subscribes, we're kind of under the umbrella of LEBA, and that stands for the Law Enforcement Bicycle Association. And that was the first association started by some of those Seattle guys. And then they kind of took their program nationally and got other cities involved and started this organization to standardize the training. Since then, another group is broken off, IPIMBA, but it's all these acronyms.
It's the same in mountain biking too. Yeah, we have similar training.
So we're under the LEBA umbrella. So we have a handful of officers that have been through LEBA's instructor school, and then we put on our own classes and certify our own people. Some outside agencies around us, maybe Milwaukee or Beaverton or Gresham, might send a person through our class because they're not offering a class anytime soon and they want to get somebody trained. So we'll take officers from other agencies. But we hold them to LEBA standards. And the LEBA class is pretty much a three-day class, and then we've kind of made our class 4 days.
That's a long time.
It's a long time.
That's a lot of coverage.
Yeah. There's a lot of classroom, but there's also a lot of in the saddle time.
What kind of things are you covering in the training?
Because
I can't imagine, I teach bicycle.
You can't imagine filling 4 days worth of stuff?
That's a lot.
It is a lot.
That's a lot. So what are you filling it with?
They get basic bike nomenclature, and this is how you ride a bike, and they get the rules of the road. But then a lot of specific stuff that's police related. You know, how do you contact a person with the bicycle? You know, what do you do with the bicycle? Do you stay straddled on the bicycle? Do you dismount the bicycle? So we go over all of that stuff. But at least half the course time is spent riding and practicing cone drills. Just similar, we were talking before the show about when you go get your driver's license, you know, you get the examiner in the car with you and you have to go the course. We have an obstacle course that they have to pass. They have to go up and down stairs. We have these slow speed cone courses.
Are they steep stairs?
No, not
good,
too
good.
Steep.
Good. I was like, because going up steep stairs, it's easier going down them, but like going up them?
There's a flight we love to use right there in Waterfront Park at about, what is it, Davis? It's 4 steps and a landing and 4 more steps in the bottom.
So you can get a little boost.
And they're very shallow steps, yes. And they're very broad. So going down them is a piece of cake, but they're also pretty easy with a little bit of practice to go up them. You know, it's all about keeping your energy going and keeping the pedals and keeping your weight forward. So,
right. Yeah. Wow. That's...
So we have those drills. We have this M-box, which is really tight 180-degree turns, so they have to be able to complete that without falling over, without putting their foot down, and without touching the cones.
I'm generally riding a bike that when I think it's heavy, like today I'm carrying maybe 20 pounds of stuff or something because I have library books to return, that I think that's heavy. I think I'm like, whoa, I got a lot today. I'm sure the bikes are extra sturdy themselves, and then how much weight are you putting on those bikes?
So
as well?
Our bikes are pretty beefy bikes to begin with. Beefy wheels so that, you know, we put big 100, 200 plus pound cops on them and we're not bending wheels and breaking spokes all the time. So they're heavy bikes to begin with. And then we put a rack on them and bags. But officers alone are carrying, you know, 25 pounds of extra gear with
themselves,
them.
Their person.
I always say 25 to 30. You know, a patrol officer in a car that's wearing boots is probably closer to 30 pounds, but as bike officers, we get to wear shorts and, you know, tennis shoes or, you know, cycling specific shoes. So we can lighten the load a little bit, but you're still carrying all that other gear. You got your vest, your belt, the ammo, the handcuffs, the radio. And those guys working downtown, they're carrying 2 radios because there's a little partnership with the downtown security company.
Oh, okay.
So calls will come in through that security company as well. So they're monitoring both the police radio and the security radio, and they become a liaison between those two entities. So they can get places faster. I tell the businesses downtown, call the security company because you're probably going to get me faster than call 911.
That's amazing. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're here with Officer Todd Engstrom, Advanced Academy Coordinator, or one of the Advanced Academy Coordinators for the Portland Police Bureau Training Division, discussing how the Portland Police Bureau utilizes bikes and the training that bicycle cops in the Bureau receive. So that's a lot of weight.
It is a lot
of
weight.
That's like, well, and I don't weigh 200 plus pounds on top of that.
I'm not a small person. I haven't seen anything under 200 pounds on a scale since high school. So, you know, I'm 230 and then add another 25. So, you know, 200.
Those have got to be some really beefy
pounds.
Wheels. That's a lot.
When we went to 29ers, we were bending wheels left and right. And then we figured out because the bikes we were buying, I don't want a bad mouth, the bike company.
You don't have to use the company's name. Yeah.
But they were just kind of stock bikes.
Right.
They were designed for police work.
Well, and that was part of my question is was it just a stock bike that you were buying?
Well, so traditionally, there's companies, and I'll throw a bunch of companies that make police-specific bikes. So Trek makes one. Fuji, Raleigh makes one.
Oh, interesting. I didn't even know that was a
they
thing.
They have
a
model. Yeah. It's probably buried in their catalog somewhere. You might have to pull up a specific page. But those are the big ones. And we've bought lots of Treks over the years and lots of Fujis over the years. And then when I was in the bike unit in 2012 is when we decided we were going to go to 29er bikes. And we went.
And for those listeners who don't know, a 29er bike is a slightly larger wheel, which is going to make going up and down those stairs more comfortable and easier. It means with every pedal stroke that you have, you're because the wheel size is bigger, you're going to go a little farther with each pedal stroke. Mm-hmm. So it's advantageous, yes, to say the least. As long as the wheels don't bend.
And that's what, you know, because we're going up and down curbs. You know, we're not just getting on the road and riding from point B, from point A to point B. We're up and down curbs and we're hard on the equipment. So we were bending wheels. And so we figured out we needed to get beefier wheels for the back with more spoke count. And that was helping. But then we realized that I think some of these companies were just selling this package and it wasn't the highest quality components and frames and, you know, gears. So now what we've done is we've just found a good mountain bike that suits our purpose. So we were buying some on one bicycles and just steel frames, very beefy, sturdy bikes. And then recently we just started buying some Marins. But they're not a police package. They're something that anybody can buy. And we try to find ones with subdued colors, you know, something right, that kind of matches the uniform a little bit. But that's a little harder to do.
Finding a bike in the color you want is honestly the hardest thing. Because the bike you want is hardly ever any color you
want. And all the police package bikes will come in black or white.
Right.
You know,
right.
So nice neutral colors. And you can put your police department stickers on them if you want to. But so these Marins we're buying now are kind of a dark blue with light blue writing. They look good. And they're nice bikes.
Well, I'm sure. Like, and there's so much stuff on your bikes.
So I have an all-important question about that. Do police bikes, or the ones that you're using, have a kickstand?
Yes. Okay. We put kickstands on them.
All right. Good to know.
We even in class, we teach this kickstand dismount. Uh-huh. So they're really sturdy kickstands that are they're spring-loaded. And we teach this dismount, so where you cross your leg over the bike, so you're still coasting. So you're coming up to where you want to stop. You swing, you dismount the bike, but you're still on the pedals. You're still coasting forward. And you have to reach back with your foot and put that kickstand down without looking at it and focus on where you're going, put it down and kind of park the bike all in one motion without that bike falling over and walk away from that bike.
I have the feeling that your police officers would be good cyclocross racers.
Yes.
Maybe.
Because I can't do what you're describing. I would have to really practice.
We call it the Starbucks dismount because there's not a lot of tactical purpose for it other than riding up to the Starbucks and, you know, kicking this boat. It's a cool looking dismount.
Sounds cool.
Most of the time we're just dropping them on the ground, but anyway, that's one of the things that they learn in the class.
Is that part of the certification from LEVA?
It's part of the testing. They need to be able to complete that. Yes, that is in the lesson plan.
I can see in the long term, even though it's not really necessary, it does, like, that balance of being on one side of the bike, being able to manipulate it. That's a difficult thing to do.
And when I teach it, especially if you have somebody that we talked about that hasn't ridden a bike for 10 years, you know, we're riding around and we just kind of play follow the leader. So if I'm leading, we'll be pedaling along and we dismount, you just swing your leg over, but yet you're still on the one pedal, you're still coasting forward. Just being able to balance the bike on one side of the bike is difficult for people.
I know you can. I've seen you do it. It's difficult for me. It feels
insecure.
Again, give me an hour of practice and I could probably totally do it.
I'm sure you could.
But it freaks me out and I just, yeah.
We'll do that a bunch of times where you're just swinging your leg over and learning to coast, and then you learn to find the kickstand and put it down and then learn to stop. And the start is all the reverse. So we want them to start the same way. So they stage that pedal. So it'd be the left pedal. They put it up kind of in that 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, you know, clock position. And you put your left foot on it and you push forward and you push down on that pedal. You get your momentum going forward and then you swing your leg over.
I do not definitely mount that way. What is the logic of
you're
why?
Going already?
You're going, you're moving forward. Easier on the bike, easier on the body, looks nicer. You know, if you have to jump off that pedal, say you get propelled forward, but yet you need to stop real quick, you're already off the bike. You haven't really committed to swinging your leg over. I don't know.
I'm like, I could make some, as somebody who teaches people how to ride bikes, I can make some serious arguments as to why that's not.
Because you would always advocate for a leg over and then start.
You're not a leg over, your butt on the saddle.
Oh, wow.
Your butt completely on the saddle.
When you start.
With your pedal in power position.
Okay, for balance.
For balance and security, because you have, if you're holding the brakes, with your foot that's off the pedal, it's on the ground, and your two wheels make a triangle. So you're like mm-hmm. a table. You're very stable.
Okay.
And then you push the pedal down and propel yourself forward.
Talking about all the gear we weigh.
I was wondering if you're
standing flat footed and you have to swing your leg all the way up over your bike, over the saddle, that gets
momentum.
A little hard. But if you start the way right. we're teaching, you've already raised yourself. It's like a step.
You've raised yourself up six inches. If the gear and everything would be part of it, because trying to get on, yeah, I can totally see it. Yeah, that makes a... That's a logical. I'll buy that argument. Let's see.
I've got a question. So, about how many miles does an officer expect to put in on a bicycle shift?
So, most of us downtown, when we were riding, we'd have little computers on our bike just for that very reason. I want to know how many miles. The thing is, the downtown officers, those six that work full time, they're in the downtown core, kind of inside the 405 loop.
That's not
loop.
Very huge.
No. So, if you're just going from call to call to call, 10 miles.
Okay.
It wasn't that much.
Mm-hmm.
I personally used to like to ride the waterfront and go across the Hawthorne Bridge, ride the East Side Esplanade, come back across the Steel Bridge, and that's a 3-mile loop.
Yes.
So I would do that if I wanted to get my mileage up a little bit, but it's pretty flat. You know, yeah, not a lot of hills. Not like those guys in Seattle. If you've
right,
been to
yeah.
downtown Seattle, those guys got some legs to be climbing those hills all day long.
Yeah. Well, or some really good gears. Or both. Yeah. But I don't want to weigh 200 pounds plus another 30 pounds of gear go up the hill. That doesn't sound that fun.
I kind of like suffering on the bike, though. I don't know why. It's bizarre.
No, there are. You're not alone. There are a lot of people.
I like the challenge of getting up a hill. I think I like going up hills more than I like going downhills.
And I only like going up hills so that I can go down them. That is, yeah, it's my suffering for my reward in my world, yeah.
So to answer your question, about 10 miles on average. Those six guys, and some might do more, but that was, my daily average was about 10 miles a day.
Okay.
And do the officers that actually get that training, the street officers, how do you become a bike officer?
So
is there a waiting list? Is it a coveted position?
So first of all, you need to get the bike training. So you become a new officer, you get off probation. Probation's a year and a half. So say you have 3 to 5 years on, you say, hey, I want to go to the next bike school. So you wait till you see it advertised in the police bureau and it's advertised online and you put your name in the hat and people are selected. You know, there's a limited number of spots. We keep them, you know, about 18 people. We don't want our classes too much bigger than that because it gets a little unruly.
Mm-hmm.
You get in the class, you pass the class, you can start riding bikes at your precinct, and then when you see a position opened up in that bike unit, you put in for it. And there's an opening now. I don't know if they've posted for it. The openings don't come about very often.
To those officers out there listening, there is now an
opening. Because I know one of the afternoon guys just went back to patrol. He's now coaching. So you can't train a new officer. You know, you can't put one of the tag-along bicycles back behind you. What do they call those things? The ones that the little kids ride that attach to the seatpost?
The tag-alongs, yeah.
So he wanted to coach. He wanted to kind of further his career. So he left the bike unit. So there's an opening. But he had been there for 6 years.
Yeah, I would think that it's not a fairly coveted position that people are...
I was there 3, and that's kind of one of the shorter stints there. Mm-hmm. But I got a really good job offer, and so I moved to a different position, so
well,
it was good.
Was it this position? Or
it was, yeah.
So
the academy coordinator job, yeah.
Now you still get to play with
I get
bikes,
to still train. So, yeah. I still get to ride. We just had a class last month, so it was fun. I got to help teach that class.
Did everybody pass?
Everybody did pass that
awesome.
Class. Yeah.
I'm always happy when all my students pass. I feel relieved. I'm like... There's that one person you're always a little worried about. And you're
And we've had those. And we'll work with them. We'll go one-on-one with them. And it's, you know, there's set things they have to pass. Those slow speed skills, they have to be able to go up and down the
And a lot of people don't realize it's something when you teach kids, you have slow races. Like, it's much harder to go slow on a bike than it is to go fast. And it's even harder than that when you're carrying that much weight.
Yeah. And then you have some people that can sit there and just do a track stand all day long. I'm not one of those people. So,
Tell us a little bit about, in the training, officers learning how to use the bicycle as an effective tool and or defensive weapon in certain situations of crowd control. And
so I wouldn't necessarily call it a weapon. I mean, it is something that's with us. So when we have our crowd control day, you know, we teach them how to ride in formation, how to use the the bicycle, so a line of bicycles as a mobile fence.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, when we have protests, the bike units are kind of standing off. You know, there was a time years ago, and when I was in the bike unit, where we were right there mm-hmm. alongside the crowd.
I remember that.
Yeah, and so
I was in that crowd.
Okay, and I think we've gotten smarter. Mm-hmm. I think we found that just incited the crowd. It's better if we're a couple blocks off and we come in when we're needed.
Okay.
And so that's what we've been doing. That's our tactic that we've been using lately, is we're just a couple blocks off. We listen to the radio, the police radio. We know where the head of the march is and the tail of the march is. And if we're needed to come in because there's an eruption in the middle and people are breaking things, then we can slide in.
Okay.
In crowd control scenarios, we're just kind of basically using them as a fence. Or there's a way that we can kind of slice them into a crowd. Say we have somebody that needs to be rescued in the middle of a group. We can kind of take this line of bicycles and kind of cut into the crowd and separate them from the crowd and get them out.
Uh-huh.
We do teach some defensive things with the bicycle in the class. And this is not so much for a crowd control situation, but say you're out on patrol and some crazy, you know, methed out person comes screaming at you with a knife. What are you going to do? You have this bicycle that you're mounted on. Okay. You know, what do? Do you get off the bike? Do you put the bike between you and them? Do you, you know, throw the bike at them? You know, those are things that we talk about, and we don't throw the bike at them, but you can dump it down on the ground in front of them to create that barrier. So mm-hmm. now they have to step through or step around that bike, which buys you a half a second or so to decide what else you're going to do. There's one defensive drill where we'll take the bike and you hold the rear brake and pop it up onto its rear wheel, and then you can kind of keep the person at bay with uh-huh. the bicycle, and you leave the front brake alone, because if you hold the front brake and they grab your front tire, now everything's rigid and they can move you
uh-huh.
with your bicycle. But if you leave that front brake off, then that wheel just kind of spins.
Ooh, as a woman, I like
it's
that.
It's a good defensive measure,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a super good. Yeah. I love hearing that.
Yeah.
So
that makes me feel safer if I ever needed it.
Grab rear brake.
Don't put
pop the wheelie.
And don't grab the front
brake. Leave it loose, because now they can't really get a hold of you. They're going to try to grab and pull on that bike, and that wheel's just going to kind of spin around in a circle. And you could kind of dance around in place and keep them at bay around you. And I mean, I guess if you needed to bounce the tire off their forehead, you could.
Hopefully not.
But everything needs to be justified.
Okay? Let's hope not. Well, it's been really great having you here today and learning all about how the bikes are used and how the training. I mean, that alone, that tip alone was totally worth it.
Yeah, okay, priceless.
And it was great having you.
Thank you very much. I love talking bicycles.
Yeah,
if I could go out to my barn and just work on bicycles all day long, I'd be so happy. But my wife would never see me.
Well, I'm assuming. Let's see. You said you were 23 years in.
Yeah.
That you're hopefully getting closer to retirement.
Maybe you need a partner in the mobile bike business, bike shop business.
That's not my business. But yes, we can talk later. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO Portland and KBOO FM and 90.7 FM. Stay with us for the second half of our show when we hear Sergeant Steve Wicks of the Houston Police Department's homeless outreach program to talk about how bikes are helping connect people living outside to services. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the KBOO Bike Show on 90.7 FM. Today, we're taking a look at how bikes are used in policing. Our next guest, Sergeant Steve Wicks, founded the Houston Police Department's Homeless Outreach Program in 2011. As an innovative and exciting idea, Sergeant Wicks pitched it after attending a conference on problem-oriented policing, which planted the seeds that have grown into a highly coordinated program that it is today. It's a new approach to policing that puts outreach and connection before enforcement, and it's having a huge effect on Houston policing. Sergeant Wicks, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. I've been watching a lot of videos and things about the police department. And one of the things that your department has specifically is a mental health division. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that, where it came from?
Sure. I mean, we've had a relationship with our mental health authority down here for a while. We started out as just having a mental health unit, and that would be about 2007. We had a mental health unit. They decided to make them their own division in 2013. What that is we're a combination of units. I'm the sergeant over the HOT team, the homeless outreach team. We've got a CCSI program, which is chronic consumer stabilization initiative, boarding homes, and several other teams that get out there, CERT officers that form the mental health unit. So I'm just one part of the mental health unit.
So you use some acronyms there. We're going to talk in a second about what the homeless outreach team does. What do some of these other teams do?
Okay, well, a CERT team is chronic consumer stabilization. Let's see, CSI, okay, that's going to, we've got CERT teams, which is crisis intervention response teams. What that does is it's a master's level clinician, mental health clinician, that rides with the police officer, and they do the calls that are involving, mental illness.
Excellent. And this homeless outreach team, was that formed after the CERT team or before it?
Well, we were all, most of us, well, all, every member of my team is CIT certified. And so we were, CERT was first, and we formed in late 2010, early 2011 is when I started the team.
And what made you want to start the team specifically as compared to what you were doing in the CERT area?
Well, I started working for the city of Houston in 1993. I became a bike officer in 1994. So I was working at that time. All the bike officers were assigned to Special Operations Division downtown. I worked with the street population almost all the time. I mean, that was the population I worked with. So I knew the population. I knew the folks. I knew their stories. I arrested them. I tried to help them if I could. So it was just a natural transition for me because it was folks that I've been working with for years.
And at that time, though, it seems like you were in more of an enforcement position than an outreach position. Is that right?
Well, you can do both.
Right, of course. But enforcement focused?
It was enforcement focus, and as a bike officer, I was mostly enforcing, drug laws and, city ordinances, minor ordinances, and it was just, it was the population that I policed on the street.
And, I mean, is that part of what inspired you to start the homeless outreach team so that that could kind of shift a little bit from enforcement and maybe finding better solutions?
Well, what I wanted to do is I wanted another tool. I always tried to help anybody I could on the street anyway, but we needed another tool. And the outreach, my particular team, was a natural progression of something I'd been doing anyway. We, I think in the early 2000s, we ended up, I was in Special Operations Division, which was downtown, and then South Central Division, which is just outside our downtown. We began a collaboration, a once-a-month outreach, where we would try to gather all the providers together, and once a month we'd take them to people on the streets
rather than people living outside.
Yeah. Well, we would take these services to the folks on the street rather than have the folks seek out the services, because the folks on the street, they've got issues, and it's hard for them to do the 5 or 10 things they need to do in order to, get off the street.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's even just the starting of getting from where they live or are staying to the services. That takes, sometimes they're miles away, or you need bus fare or things like that.
Or they can't do 6 things. It's provider bureaucracies are extremely frustrating. I mean, they're frustrating for me to deal with. A person that has no transportation and other issues, it's almost impossible. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to connect the people with the resources and get them off the street so we could eliminate all the problems of them being on the street.
Excellent. And what do you think the biggest obstacle is for people living outside to getting into permanent housing? Or when you really are reaching somebody, what's the first or the most common thing that people need?
Well, ID is huge, but that's not really the biggest thing. The biggest thing is desire. We can help anybody that wants to be helped, but in order to change your situation, you have to work. It's hard. It's hard work, and you have to really want it. So, desire, and we can connect you with resources if the desire is there.
Do you think that the program, the homeless outreach program, has helped foster that desire?
I think it's kind of changed the paradigm, the relationship paradigm between the providers, the homeless, and the police. So in that respect, yes.
And how has that relationship changed?
Well, we kind of thought when we started the team that it would be difficult to get the folks living on the street to trust us, but that wasn't really the difficult part. The difficult part was getting the providers to trust us. When we first started, the providers thought we were out to do a sweep and we were just going to, we were going to arrest the homeless on the street, and that just didn't happen. And so over the years, we've built a pretty good relationship with the providers, and we've just become a resource for them, and they were a resource for us.
So now that that's there, the people that have the desire have a night, it sounds like they've got this really clear path. When they maybe have that desire, they have a clear path to choose to go and take.
Well, yeah, it's a continuum. Everybody is on the streets for a reason. And the streets are a community. People like living in their community. They like hanging out with people that do the same things as them. So if they get the desire, if their issue, we work primarily with the chronic homeless. And we work with folks that are addicted and have have mental health issues. So we can connect them with resources if they want it, and if they're ready to work on their barriers.
Yeah, I can definitely see where it's. Do you have relationships with people that you wish you could get help more that just have never had the desire? Are there people out there that you keep an eye on that are out there and have never had the desire to not live outside?
Well, it's all relationship focused. I mean, we know the folks by name. We know why they're there, and once they get the desire, if they get the desire, I mean, there's people out there with mental illness that are really not capable of ever wanting. They have no insight to their condition, so they're not going to seek change, and that's sad. I mean, it's the mental health aspect of this is really sad, because they're the true victims out there. I mean, people choose addiction, but people with mental illness don't.
Yeah. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're here with Sergeant Steve Wicks of the Houston Police Department's Homeless Outreach Program to talk about how bikes are helping connect people living outside to services and permanent homes. So I know you're not a bike, your entire division or team is not on bikes, but you are. Why do you choose the bicycle?
Because I love it. It's something, I've been riding a bike pretty much on and off since 94, and it's a great way to patrol. It's a great way to talk to people. I mean, I've got the best job in the world. I get to talk to people. I get to try to solve problems, and I get to just ride a bike.
And you've been riding a bike as an officer since 94. Were you an officer before that?
Yeah, I've been an officer since 1980.
Oh.
Houston is my fourth police department. So, and I worked for Houston for 25 years. So.
And oh, go ahead, April.
I was going to say, back in 1994, when you started police work by bicycle, was there a training, a specific training and a certification for that?
Sure. We went through a 40-hour training course. Bikes was brand new back then. We were kind of like the red-haired stepchild of the police department. They really didn't know how to use us.
Mm-hmm.
The Rockets, our basketball team, won a couple of back-to-back championships. So they started utilizing bikes in the parade. And it's a really great way. I mean, we've used them in the Super Bowls now, and it's just a great way to patrol. You don't have to worry about one-way streets or getting to a call. I can get anywhere in the downtown as fast as a car can, if not faster.
Yeah, I think we find that here in Portland too. Is you're just so much more nimble on a bike than you are in a vehicle, especially when there's big crowds like what you're describing. Do you feel like your bicycle is an advantage in the work that you do, or do you feel like everybody should be on bikes?
Without a doubt, it's an advantage. I mean, I wish I knew all the people by name that know me by name. I mean, I've been doing it for a long, long time, and I know the folks who live on the street, especially in the downtown and within 20 miles of the downtown area.
Wow, that's a huge range. So we had an officer here who said most of Portland's training and most of Portland's utility of bikes is within the downtown core. How much do you end up riding on an average day?
It just depends. Usually 20... on a day when I stop and have to... when I talk to people, 15 to 25 miles a day.
Wow. That's impressive, especially after Officer Engstrom just told us how much weight that and described the bikes you guys are riding. It doesn't seem like it's an easy task to bike around.
It's something you get used to. It's wearing the vest in the summertime in Houston is kind of tough, but it's something you get used to.
Yeah.
And so do you think, I mean, it sounds like you're relatively famous in what you do and in the area that you're working in, but are other officers, do you think, drawn to policing by bicycle as you do?
Policing by bicycle, I think you kind of have to be, you've kind of got to want to do that. Houston at one time required every person in Special Operations Division, which was the downtown division at that time, to be bike certified. But if you're not motivated to get out there on a bike, you'd much rather drive a car around.
Yeah,
I guess it's just human nature. So it's the those of us who enjoy bikes, really love what we do, but you've got to be motivated to do it.
Well, and how many people besides yourself on your team use bikes?
Well, I've got a case manager that rides regularly. I've got another sergeant that rides with me regularly, and my other guys say they're kind of fair weather riders. I'll get out there unless it's raining. I'll get out there.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because I also noticed on some of the videos about what you do that if you are helping connect somebody to services or maybe getting them into some kind of detox program or whatever, you guys have a van that will help them both move their belongings. So which would be difficult to do by bike, unless you had a tandem and a trailer.
And we've also got two wheelchair accessible vans, and we really transport a lot of people who are in wheelchairs. So it's my team has grown to the point where we've got I've got six officers plus a Metro police officer, which is our transit authority, who's permanently assigned to the team, and I've got three case managers through the Harris Center, which is our mental health authority. So we've got four vans, a truck, you know, bikes, let's see, four vans, two wheelchair accessible, truck, bikes, and ATV.
And for you personally, how is the bicycle, apart from the fact that you can do things relatively easily getting around in the downtown core, how else do you feel that the bicycle enhances what you do?
Well, I think it allows people, I'm very approachable on a bike. And I'm, you know, I'm approachable. People don't really, when I used to do enforcement, and outreach and enforcement are two different things. I really don't do a lot of enforcement now, mostly outreach. But when I was doing enforcement, I mean, you would roll up on people smoking crack, you know, every day. And, you know, it's a great way to patrol, much, much better than a car.
What do you do? I can't imagine rolling up on somebody actively using crack in that moment. How do you handle that?
Well, pretty much, you know, just like you handle
anything. Do they want to put it down when they see you? Do they like...
Oh, they'll throw the pie.
Okay. So they stop, you know, smoking whatever. When you approach. They're not like...
Usually. I mean, crack is not our big problem right now. Kush is our problem. And Kush is the synthetic cannabinoid that they spray on potpourri.
Oh, yeah. I think Chicago's having some problems with that right now,
you know,
too.
It's so cheap, and everybody is smoking it. It's kind of, it falls through a legal loophole, and then it's very hard to enforce the laws against Kush.
And it's got some weird side effects.
Well, it's more like a meth high than it's not marijuana.
Yeah.
When they were trying to synthesize the, you know, marijuana for the good stuff, they came up with the designer drug, and they sprayed on potpourri, and people add stuff to it. You know, here they add, well, everything. They add roach spray. They add, you know, soma. They add formaldehyde. They add, you know, powdered cocaine. It's just, they add stuff to it, but... Most of the guys that I deal with are just straight Kush smokers.
Okay, that sounds still incredibly. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's much better than crack.
Well, it's a lot cheaper than crack, so I think it's much worse than crack.
Is it as addictive as crack?
It's very, very addictive. Okay. People on Kush don't want to do anything. They can't eat. They can't go to the bathroom. They can't. They just want to smoke Kush. And they go. They have seizures. You know, we call them Kush zombies because they just fall out. And you know, our ambulances are constantly being called to transport people on Kush.
Wow, that is very sad and very hard. I know in one of the videos they talked about how this kind of changed how. The population of the people living outside interacted with the police. You said they were more eager to accept it, but that they'll even call you now if they're having problems within.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the huge things we do is when I first started the team, we discovered that lack of ID is a huge barrier for folks in the street. In Texas, you need a birth certificate and two supporting documents, in order to get a driver's license. And the folks on the street, they store their stuff, they lose it, and they lose these documents. So if they don't have ID, they're kind of shut out. And that's one of the really biggest things that we did. We developed an ID that our Department of Public Safety accepts for identifying the folks in the street and allows them back into the system where they were, you know, where they were locked out before.
That's amazing. That's really amazing.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. And I noticed that they have, they use some like portable fingerprint technology that helps with that.
Yeah, that's the AFIS, Automatic Fingerprint Identification System, I believe. And yes, we do. But in order to have your prints on file with AFIS, you would have to have been arrested for a higher grade crime in the past. So if you're not in the system, that's not going to help a lot. But we have access to the databases that will allow us to ID folks, and when we ID them, we're 100% sure of who they are.
If you could kind of proselytize this program to other cities beyond Houston, What would you say would be the biggest sell for other places to take on a program like this, and is it even cost effective?
Well, it's another tool. Cost effective, that's kind of a hard question to answer, because I do know that if I take a chronic alcoholic off the street, get him into housing, I'm going to eliminate all the problems that guy gets into when he's on the street, all the low level ordinance violations. If we can get somebody off the street, we can eliminate all the stuff that they do on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we really do. I mean, I've had people from all over the country call and ask for information on our team, and we teach in our academy. So we've kind of changed the officer's attitude towards folks on the street. I get referrals from officers all over the city who have talked to somebody that wants help, and if they want it, we can find it for them.
Well, it seems like that's an amazing benefit to people who aren't part of the team, that they now have, they even know of this resource and who to go to, and that they have a direct link to connect someone with. That's an amazing benefit to this program.
Yeah, it's definitely another tool, and it's a tool that we need. I mean, I wish I wish it was a solution, but it's just a tool, and it's one that we use, pretty effectively.
Well, it seems like, a larger solution would involve, better mental health better mental health accessibility for anyone, to keep them from maybe ending up on the streets in the first place, and et cetera. But that's
a tragedy. The tragedy is there is really no long-term mental health help for a lot of the folks on the street.
Yep.
It's very, very difficult. We have hard cases that are people that are very difficult to help, and we, look for ways to fit them into the system, to get them help, but it's difficult. Capacity assessments for guardianship are very, very hard for us to get. Getting someone into the guardianship program, getting someone that has a payer source so that we can, we can get them off the street. Those are all issues that we pretty much face every day, but I've got a bunch of good folks on my team, and they do a great job at figuring out solutions to those kind of problems.
I think that's what it takes, is a team and coming up with innovative new ideas like this one, that you're not just, it almost seems like the homeless outreach team is preventative, that you're saving kind of taxpayers money in the long run, in that you're not going to have as much crime, you're not going to have people maybe using emergency rooms as much if they're able to get some treatment, get off the street, and have a more stable life.
Well, even more than that, we've opened up a window into a segment of the population that was invisible before this. We have, if we'll have our district attorney's office call us and say, hey, we're looking for a witness to such and such a crime, or we're looking for a complainant on a sexual assault, they're living on the streets, can you help us find them? We've helped our homicide division solve a pretty grisly murder that happened a few years ago on one of our bayous. And it's just because we have a relationship with the folks on the street and we know them. So we're able to, we're able to help folks connect people with the outside world.
Yeah, seeing people and acknowledging them and bringing back their humanity really is the first step.
Oh, I agree.
Well, thank you so much, Sergeant Steve Wicks, for joining us today. It was really great having you. If our listeners want to find out more about your program, where can they find some information?
Well, I think we've got, they can just, go onto the internet and look up Houston Police Department Mental Health Division, and, our unit is linked on there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. My pleasure, too. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We'll have links to all our guests' websites on our Facebook page. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by myself, April Streeter, Alon Robb, and Terry Campbell. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Jenka, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guest, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook, at our Twitter handle, at KBOO Bike Show, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month for more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
And the time is 12 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How to Train, Pugs at Work, on Thursday, April 5th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Studio 1 at KBOO Radio. Portland Underground Graduate School hosts a one-day workshop on how people learn, how to teach where your learner is, and what they need to know, and how to implement it in your professional and personal life. Again, that's How to Train, Pugs at Work, on Thursday, April 5th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Studio 1 at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. Today marks 50 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee. King was in Memphis to support striking sanitation workers. Those workers made the equivalent of $12 an hour.